you thought it was a game. See, I'm not, the bishop is still praying for me. I come from the school of Tupac. I'm a rider. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a straight rider.
Y'all wanna mess
you don't wanna what?
Mess with me.
See, I'm not your average Negro.
Hold up. Taz, I want to ask you a question real quick.
Let's just keep it real straight shot with no tape. I'm going to get a little bit rough.
It's about standing for justice. And
you either with us or you not. I'm here for those who really believed in the American process, all of us.
You play with me if you want to. We don't stand for him. Who we? See, I'm not your average Negro.
Hold up.
Straight shot, no chaser. With your girl, Tesla Figaro, on the Black Effect Podcast Network.
What's good, family? This is Tesla Figaro, the host of Straight Shot, No Chaser. It has been a minute because obviously we needed to get through the election and get some results before I started interviewing again. And I could not think of anyone better as the first guest returning back from the election results. No one better that I think we should probably talking to at this particular moment is Bishop Talbert Swan. He represents, I would say, and he can certainly correct me, I would say the left side of politics. And a lot of folks say that the left side is the right side. So those of you who have listened to the podcast, you know, I do my best to bring both perspectives from the right, the left, independent, progressive. I also try to bring every voice to the table, pastors, politicians, gangsters, you name it. And so today I want to get right into it with Bishop Swan and welcome him to the show. Thank you, Bishop, for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Thank you so much. You seem so quiet compared to how I've always seen you.
I'm a forced extrovert. I'm actually an introvert, but because of my position as a pastor and some other public roles, I'm kind of forced to be out there. But when you catch me one-on-one, I'm the quiet guy standing in the corner.
Really? And yeah. I wouldn't have known that.
Yeah.
But when you get in, when you get loud, you definitely you get with it. So yeah, I wouldn't absolutely have thought you were just quiet in the corner. That's interesting. I wanted to have you on to just get straight to it. You know, I know you have been a very, very vocal advocate for or against, you know, the President Trump administration. You have certainly made your position known publicly, which is one of the criticisms that I have of a lot of ministers that hide under the pews when it's time to speak up. Even if I disagree with your position, even if we don't have the, you know, the same ideology. And I'm not talking about you per se. I'm just saying anybody. You know, I've had Pastor sure. Scott on the show before, which obviously he represents, you know, the Trump side of things. But I just love pastors, bishops, ministers who stand firm, you know, so that way we don't have to be confused about where you stand. And I love, you know, tying in politics to scriptural references on how we should be moving if you are a Christian or a child of God. I do say that a lot of times I don't think politics should necessarily mix with the church in a lot of ways because I've seen that abused, but it is certainly necessary to talk about when you move a hurting people, the least of these, those who really need the help that politics is designed to help. I have been disappointed to see the lack of leadership in the movement from ministers and bishops and so forth. There's a lot of folks that I could name, but when I think of at least two, I think of you and Jamal Bryant, Pastor Jamal Bryant, which are two very vocal ministers from the left side of things. And then also Bishop Barber. But you get petty with them. You get a little bit, you speak a different language. You know, the Bible said they'll send people with all types of languages. And you speak a language that I believe is so necessary and not petty in a bad way, but petty in a good way. You clap back, you respond back. You don't just lay down and roll over and take the high road. And that was really, you know, what made me interested in you. What made you, and I know you've always been involved. I know you've always done social justice, advocacy, protests. This is certainly not your first rodeo. But what is it about the Trump administration that made you feel that it was necessary to take it up another notch? And are you representing the church when you're doing that per se? Because I see people who criticize you. You know, bishops shouldn't say this and you shouldn't do that. So when you're out there speaking, particularly on Twitter, are you a representative of the church, yourself, or just speaking up because it's the right thing to do?
Well, you know, the church itself doesn't necessarily take a position on particular candidates. It does take a position on issues of concern. So from that perspective, When I talk about the need for justice and fighting against evil, that is representative of what the church ought to be doing. But ultimately, you know, as a Christian, I'm representing the kingdom. I'm representing myself as a black man in America, speaking out on behalf of the oppressed. You know, when I read scripture, I always start with what I call Jesus's entrance into his public ministry in Luke chapter 4, after he's baptized by John and he's tempted in the wilderness. He goes into the temple and he picks up the book and he reads. He says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor." And he names certain demographic groups. He talks about the poor, the brokenhearted, the sick, the imprisoned, and the oppressed. And this is how he starts his ministry. And then he spends the next 3.5 years fighting for, empowering, and inspiring those demographic groups. So I don't understand ministry, whether it's on the left or the right, anyone who calls himself a follower of Christ, who can ignore the plight of these demographics that Christ said he was called for. It's the late James Cone who said, something that really is the foundation of my ministry. He said, any authentic theology must affirm that God is on the side of the oppressed. And so when we see people being mistreated, when we see governments acting in a manner that is not in the best interest of the people, it is incumbent upon leaders from the faith community, particularly those who call ourselves Christians, to speak out on their behalf. That's what Christ would do. So how do we represent Christ if we then refuse to support those that Christ would support? And so I just see what I do, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's at a protest, whether it's my preaching from the pulpit, my advocacy through the NAACP or wherever. I see it as an extension of the ministry I've been called to do as a Christian. And for me to do anything less, I'd be abdicating my responsibility.
So basically what you're saying is that the ministry of Christ is identity politics. You broke down demographics and where people fit in that demographics. Cause you know, we'll hear a lot from the conservative side of things that, you know, identity politics, it's all identity politics. But what you're saying is it is necessary to identify certain demographics that are in the most need. Is that what I'm hearing from you? And that relates to politics.
Yeah, well, basically, they've been identified by our oppressors already. You know, the irony of white conservative males complaining about identity politics is mind-boggling when you slaughtered Native Americans because of their identity. You enslaved Africans because of their identity. You oppressed women because of their identity. You propped yourselves up as being superior because of your identity. So the entire history of America was built on identity politics. Who was subjugated, who was oppressed, who was mistreated, and then who was propped up as superior and received privilege was all based on identity. So for white men who created identity politics to talk about their disdain for identity politics is hypocrisy on steroids. So basically, yes, Jesus identified those, you know, who were being mistreated and subjugated and dehumanized, and lifted them up and empowered them and inspired them and rebuked those that mistreated them.
We see a lot of picking and choosing in politics. You know, we pick out what we like, and we see that in the Bible as well. We pick out scriptures that work for us, and then we pick out the ones that necessarily don't. And I always say that, and I am independent and I lean left, but there's conservative values that I grew up on. I think most people who, especially if they had parents from the baby boomer age and grandparents from the Depression age, you grew up at least with some conservative values, which is, I went to church every other weekend. I had one side of the family that did more sinning than the other. So one weekend I was over there in the streets, and then the next weekend I was at my grandmother's house, who's 89, my only living surviving from my family. it was church. It was Sunday school. It was BTU. What people don't know what BTU is, but that's evening service. It was 3 o'clock service. You know, that was the foundation. And so when I look at that as conservative values, when I look at how conservative she was with her money, her fiscal responsibility, I was so excited because for the very first time, my grandmother actually let me pay for something for her. You know, I feel being that she's 89 years old, you know, I said, grandmother, let me pay for your property tax. She said, oh, you don't want me to sit on my own bottom? That was her favorite phrase. And I said, well, I think you've been sitting on your bottom for 89 years. Let me sit on these taxes for you just this one time. That's the first time, Bishop, she's ever allowed or took anything from her children or grandchildren. So when I look at that conservative mindset, spend less, you know, and save more, Black folks identify with that. But because the conservative movement to me has been co-opt and taken into a direction that we can and may have always been in that direction, I'm gonna let you respond to that. But Black folks can't see themselves in that movement because in that movement, it seems to, and some would say is, not seems to, forget the individuals that you're talking about. But I want to ask you, when people say, well, what about, because they hold on to, you know, it's about faith and family. And that's why I gave that story about faith and family. And then, you know, abortion. And if you're a real Christian, you should be pro-life or same-sex marriage. What is your response to conservatives that say that there's no way that you could serve the same God that they do and not take a position on pro-life? So I want to know your answer to that and explain how I don't have to agree with everything on the left side, just like I don't agree with everything on the right side. It is about what you're most in line with. So can you break that down for those that are listening?
Absolutely. So basically what the right has done from a Christian perspective is try to make African-American Christians feel guilty in terms of their theological beliefs or doctrinal beliefs around abortion, same-sex marriage. They have chosen what I call wedge issues to say that unless you vote Republican, unless you vote conservative, you are violating God's law regarding these important issues. And sadly, there are some Black folk who have bought into that. Mm-hmm. Our pushback against that is, first of all, their pro-life stance is not truly pro-life. It's anti-abortion, because you cannot be pro-life and then tout the death penalty, justify the extrajudicial murder of Black people every time a cop kills an unarmed Black person, ignore the infant mortality rate, try to take health care away from millions of people who without it would be literally fighting for their life because they don't have the medicine and the care to keep them alive. So on every other front, you have no problem with Black and brown people dying, but you want them to be born only to be born into an America that you then push policies that say, we're not going to provide WIC, we're not going to provide health care. And then you demonize those same mothers that you want to have those children, once those children come into the world, as being irresponsible, and you send them out on their own. They're not truly pro-life. And then the other thing is, how do you choose those two issues, but then you ignore what the Bible says about how we treat the poor, how we treat the stranger, how we treat the widows? You know, I always say it like this. They major in what the Bible minors in. Mm. And they minor in what the Bible majors in. You can find one reference in the Bible that indirectly talks about abortion. You can find about four references in the Bible that deals with the issue of homosexuality. You can find over 2,000 references that deal with how we treat the poor. You can find over 2,000 references that deal with the issue of justice. Yet these same folks will stand up and say social justice is antithetical to Christianity, even though the theme of justice is interwoven throughout the Old and the New Testament over 2,000 times. So how is it that you can spend so much time speaking to what the Bible speaks to so little of, and some of which Jesus never spoke of at all, and then spend very little time on what the Bible spoke a whole lot of and what Jesus dedicated his life for. It's complete hypocrisy. And so I tell black folk who are Christian, listen, we vote based on who best represents our values and our concerns. Neither political party and no candidate, unless it's yourself or Jesus running for office, is going to align completely with what you believe. So you have to take the ones who best fit the majority of what you believe in. And I'm not going to vote for somebody simply based on where they stand on two issues, but they have proven over and over again that they are against what's in the best interest of my people. So a Donald Trump, who, first of all, we don't know that he's pro-life because he's flip-flopped on that issue 100 times. We don't know where he stands in terms of same-sex marriage or gay rights because he's flip-flopped on that issue. He says whatever is convenient. But then when you look at the fact that he's an avowed white supremacist, he's anti-black, his policies are detrimental to black and brown people. How do we vote for a guy based on those two issues on the basis of our Christianity and ignore everything else? It just doesn't jive. It doesn't fit. It doesn't go together at all.
Well, so what do you say then to people that say, you know, Joe Biden has also, you know, been anti-black, not just the words out of his mouth, but the actual actions that he has put policies in place? We all know about the crime bill, but in segregation and so forth, and has touted white segregists in a lot of his speeches and things that he's said on the floor. When we look at his record in the last 45 plus years, all of that has not always been favorable to black people. So what do you say? And as you know, Malcolm X talked about the white Dixiecrat, you know, so what do you say to those that say, okay, well, if you want to compare it to Trump, what about Joe Biden? I think I got that more than anything else. You know, those of us that are in the public space, what about Joe Biden? And then if you say something about Joe Biden, well, what about Trump? I mean, we were in the biggest what about lesser of two evils conversation that I hope will be the last for my adult life, because it was such a, it was a compare and contrast in presentation, on leadership presentation, on, you know, Joe Biden obviously has deep connections to the black community. But when you go through, when you look at policy, who actually had the pen, you know, to do things that have damaged our community, we have to be honest and say that Joe Biden fell on the majority of those things. And that has to do with the fact that he was in office for 47 years. I would hate to see what Trump's record would look like if he was in office for 47 years.
So, I hate to see what his would look like if he's in for four more years.
That's right. So what do you say to that when people say, well, what about Joe Biden? Joe Biden is just as racist. What is your answer to them?
Listen, I've been challenged so many times by our woke brothers and sisters. here he is. He's anti-Trump. He never says anything about Biden. They obviously didn't check the record because I've always been critical of Biden's record. I mean, I've done entire radio programs talking about the crime bill and criticizing the fact that he would not repudiate it and was still defending it even as he was campaigning for president. I critiqued Kamala Harris's record as a district attorney and as an attorney general. So I completely admit that his record is problematic. The crime bill is problematic. The reality is generations of black people have been disenfranchised and hurt. Our community has been hurt because of 25 years of policies that emanated from this crime bill. He said early on that it wasn't the crime bill that caused mass incarceration. It was the state courts. And we broke that down, that the crime bill incentivized the states to do harsher sentences, longer sentences, and gave them billions of dollars to build prison. And the incarceration rate doubled within 10 years of the crime bill being passed. All of that is problematic. Definitely so. But then when you look at where we are right now, when you look at the emboldening of racists in America, when you look at the increase in hate crimes, when you look at a Supreme Court that now has a major 6-3 conservative majority that is poised to strike down civil rights gains that we've had over the last 50 plus years, and the potential that the next president will be able to appoint one, maybe two more Supreme Court justices. So imagine that 6-3 going to 7-2 or 8-1, something that will last literally for the next few generations. Trump represented an existential threat, not just to America, because the reality is that whenever white America has a cold, Black America has pneumonia. And he represents an existential danger to America and definitely a danger to Black people. And we could not afford for this man to stay in office for another 4 years. He's completely remade the courts already. Mitch McConnell is reopening the Senate right now to confirm some more Trump justices. And so we have conservative young white men who are going to serve a lifetime on these courts that are going to be interpreting laws and doing things for generations to come. We couldn't afford another Trump. And so when you look at Biden, his personal record is problematic. But the reality is he is going to be held to account. Not only will he be held to account, but also he is going to be going along with a platform that is much more palatable to Black people than the Republican platform. He at least has a left wing, a progressive wing of his own party that is going to be challenging him. Nobody in the Republican Party has the intestinal fortitude to challenge Trump. The Republican Party is the party of Trump. So there are no checks and balances within that party. There's no one who has the guts to say to Donald Trump, you need to stop this or you need to stop that. There's no one who will stand up to him. At least on the Democratic side, we have the progressive wing of the party who will stand up to Biden, you know, who will hold him accountable. And so, like you said before, the conversation is about the lesser of two evils. Unfortunately, that's what Black and brown people find themselves in most races. And in this particular race, yes, we had to choose the lesser of two evils. And Joe Biden is definitely far less of a threat to us than Donald Trump represented.
That was interesting how you put that. And I know people needed to hear it, just like you said, when you talked about at least there's, you know, someone within the party or a group of folks within the party that will challenge. Because the way you framed it, I don't think people look at it that way.
Think about it even now, with him not conceding office, having the GSA withhold funds from Biden's transition team, nobody in the Republican Party is standing up and saying, hey, man, you need to give this up and let's have a smooth transition of power. They're all afraid of him. Could you see this happening on the Democratic side? No. By contrast, when Hillary Clinton was poised to launch a legal fight in 2016, Barack Obama called her and said, don't do it for the benefit of America. Concede. She had someone within the party willing to check her. That does not happen on the Republican side.
And do you think we always get that right on the left side? Because when you mention Hillary Clinton, for example, one of the things that a lot of people had issue with, and even I did, was that she was the chosen one. And just for clarity, for those listening, I supported Hillary Clinton when she ran against Barack Obama when she came out the first time. But I didn't like in 2016, you know, only two or three people were basically told to sit down. I mean, let's just be honest about it. So do you think we always, I know you probably don't, but you will admit that we don't always get this checks and balance thing right either.
Right, right. There are times that we don't get that right. And there are times in which there is an anointed one that we're told that we need to walk in lockstep with and support. I don't think we saw that this past election.
That's right.
You know, we had a large cadre of individuals to choose from who were thoroughly vetted throughout the primary process until it finally got whittled down to a particular candidate. And I'm glad it happened that way this time. But the reality is, Black folks, what we've got to do is we've got to create a coalition. Black folks, Latinos, Native Americans, you know, non-white folks have got to have a coalition where we hold the Democrats accountable. Because without us, they don't win. The reality is this. 55% of white women voted Republican, voted for Trump. All right. Nearly 60% of white men. Well, so the majority of white folks are going to vote for the Republican nominee, no matter how you slice it. Democrats cannot win without us. And therefore, they have a responsibility to be accountable to us.
When you say now, us, one thing, I don't want to interrupt you, but break, who is us? Because I want to get into that.
Look, I'm talking primarily about black folk, but you have to put in there, because they couldn't do it just with black folk. You know, black folk, Latinos, and other non-white folks. Jamal Bryant put it like this. He said, Joe Biden did something that no president has ever done, not even Barack Obama, the other night when he thanked black people in particular. And then he said, he thanked them for having his back and then said, and I'll have your back. So he admitted publicly, I could not be here without you. And so I owe you. And we've got to make sure that we cash in on that IOU.
Speaking of cash in, because you mentioned a coalition, there's concerns out there that we're always a part of the coalition, but the coalition, the folks in the coalition are worried about their own folks. You know, Hispanics are concerned about Hispanics. Asian Americans are concerned about Asian Americans. Those other non-white groups, it seems that black people are always showing up for the team sport, but then when it's time, when it's solo dolo time, nobody's showing up for us, and that is how we end up at the bottom of the barrel. Now, I will say this, Bishop, that I think it is important that we have people in different spaces that do different things, you know, to build those coalitions. I am not anti-coalition at all. My concern and what I try to do is to make sure that black people are also comfortable with standing for black issues, even if we have to stand for ourselves. Obviously, we know the data. You can't just win for black folk. Obviously, we don't have the population to just completely, you know, elect a president that will only work for the good of black people. I think we like to think that that's possible, but obviously the president has to serve everybody. But how do we make sure that we get that slice of the pie if every time we go to cut the pie, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller because of this big tent, everybody coalition type thing, and we find ourselves at the bottom when we talk about minority businesses. We find women and Hispanics and Asians and so many others that benefit from that because they have the resources, the access to capital, the things that I just don't have as a black woman. So how do we hold him accountable for that and not keep getting excluded and put out the game because of this quote unquote coalition?
Yeah, we've got to hold not only the president, we've got to hold black elected officials accountable for standing up for us. See, what happens far too often is our own people will get into office and then they will be reticent to speak specifically on behalf of us. The main problem that many folks, black folks, have with the Democrat Party, and there's legitimacy to their grievance. When we look at some who are saying, don't vote, when we look at some who said, I'm going to vote Republican as a rebuke to the Democrat Party, you have to, at the very least, look at the legitimacy of their complaint in that Democrats can have a specific policy agenda for the LGBTQ community, for the Jewish community, for immigrants, for DACA, you know, for hunchbacks and one-legged people. But then when it comes to a specific agenda for black people, it's always a rising tide lifts all boats philosophy. That no, this isn't specifically for black people, but black people will benefit too, you know, along with everybody else. And we're saying, no, we don't want to benefit too. We want an agenda that benefits us. We want to have a real conversation about what it is that you need to do for black people. We don't want to study reparations. You know, it's old. Just figure out how you're going to do it. I mean, the reality is when COVID hit, and white folks were affected by COVID, you found $2 trillion under a mattress somewhere. So the money is there. You just have to have the resolve to do something about it. So this whole thing about passing something to study reparations, that frustrates black people and rightfully so. And so we definitely need to hold Democrats accountable. And many feel like we do it by our vote. And that if the Republicans keep on winning long enough, maybe the Democrats will turn around and say, okay, black people, what do we need to do in order to win you back? Is it that we need to start a third party that will be powerful enough to negotiate? But whatever, I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that that is fueling the frustration that black people have, that for the last 60 years, we have been your most loyal constituency. But every time we talk about a black agenda, it's always let's wait till after the election, or it's always coupled in with benefits from some other non-white group that might help us as well.
What's your thoughts on, you know, reparation? You know, a lot of folks see it as just getting a check and not all of the components that go with building communities, which, of course, a lot of those are out there now where they say, quote unquote, minority communities, disadvantaged communities, poor communities, which, again, is not directly affecting when we talk about black communities. But again, let's be logical. Everybody in the quote unquote black community may not be black. You know, you have Hispanics mm-hmm. that live in that area. You have non-whites that live in the hood, too. If we just gonna say, when I say the hood, I don't necessarily mean a bad place. I'm just talking about where black people, the majority of black people, live. I live in a city that's 46% black, and it is a middle class city. But middle class, black middle class, is still not caught up to white middle class. Mm-hmm. So are you along the lines of the money being distributed in cash form in addition to the resources? Or are you one of those folks that say, as long as we're putting the resources and it directly benefits the descendants of those who were enslaved, that's just as good. Where's your thought on that? Because when we say study, I agree that study in the politician's mind is withholding. Mm-hmm. But do you think we have got to a clear understanding of what, you know, as a whole, what is it that we're asking for? Because I hear people with different positions. So what's your thoughts on that?
I believe it's two separate issues. So, and I don't want to juxtapose the plight of black people in a nation that is still hampered by systemic racism with what is historically owed to us for years of uncompensated labor. I believe that addressing the disparities that exist in every facet of American society, whether it's the criminal justice system, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in jobs and opportunity, whether it's in fair housing, that needs to be done separate and apart from reparations.
Okay.
And I don't want to hear a conversation about if we do this, this is a form of reparation. No, don't tell me that if we do what we ought to be doing in a society that is supposed to be fair and just for everybody that lives in it, it's reparations. No, it's what you ought to be doing. Now, when it comes to reparations, people have critiqued and criticized and said, listen, if you give black folks a check, if you give them large sums of money, they're going to go out and buy cars. They're going to go out and do this. They're going to go out and do that. Well, here's my thing. It ain't none of your business what I do with my money. If you owe me some money, okay, if I worked for you, or if my grandfather, great-grandfather worked for you for X number of years, and there's an accumulation that you owe to me, it's not up to you to tell me what I can and can't do with that, what I should or shouldn't do with. That's none of your business. They didn't tell Native Americans what to do with reparations. They didn't tell the descendants of the Japanese that they held in internment camps in World War II what to do with the money when they gave them reparations. It's only when it comes to black people do we start critiquing our spending habits and what we might do with the money and why you shouldn't give it to us. No, if you owe me money, give me my money. Now, we can have the conversation among ourselves on how do we pool our resources? How do we invest? How do we best utilize any resources that we receive to benefit the black community? That's a conversation we can have ourselves. But nobody who owes me money has the right to stand over me and tell me what to do with it once I get it.
And why do you think black people, because it's a lot of black people that say that too. Do you think, like just from the minister in you, is it pain talking when black folks say that you don't want other black folks to benefit? What is it, jealousy? Is it envy? Is it, I only want to be the only one at the top? Why do you think that is, that some of the biggest distractors of reparations is black folks? Because, you know, they love trying to say, well, black people agreed too, just like what they did with the crime bill. Oh, well, black people told Biden to do it. Well, that's okay. You got black folks who are right and wrong at the same time. And again, kind of going back to that, not to rehash, but the issue with Biden was publicly admitting that it was a problem. Right. And then how do we move forward instead of just being stubborn? But going back to the reparations conversation, why do you think it is that black people, that they're some of the biggest proponents? It would never happen. It's not going to happen. You have to get a house in the Congress, you know, the House and the Senate on board, which is true. Mm-hmm. But a lot of folks, I don't think it's because they're questioning the political strategy. I think some people just don't want to see other black people have the money. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a combination of this Stockholm syndrome, internalized oppression syndrome that we have as a people, that we start agreeing with the rhetoric and the narrative of our oppressor. And we start looking upon ourselves as they look upon us. And so then you have these black folks who look at us with disdain and say what we would or wouldn't do and why we should or shouldn't get something. I saw the other day James Clyburn being interviewed, and they asked him, what do you want from the Biden administration for South Carolinians delivering to him that victory in the primaries that really set him on the road toward the presidency? What do you want for black people delivering to him this victory in the presidency? He said, I don't want anything. And I was shocked by that. Not really shocked.
Wasn't shocked.
but you know, I'm like, how do you as a black man sit there and say, I don't want nothing? You don't want anything? You know, and there are many of us that think along those lines forget about it. That was a long time ago. You know, we shouldn't be worried about that kind of thing. I don't understand that concept, because that doesn't apply to anyone else. I mean, to this day, they are still hunting down Nazi war criminals. Okay. And in America, you know, if you ever go out and get the book Without a Sanctuary, and you look at the pictures of black folk being lynched and hung and white folks sitting around roasting marshmallows with their kids and stuff, they could have a long time ago identified some of those criminals and brought them to justice. But we don't do that in America when it comes to black people. And we've got to stop repeating the narrative of our oppressor. We are old. We worked all those years without compensation. Then we worked another number of years sharecropping. Then we worked a number of other years getting wages that weren't fair. I mean, we're old, way above the 40 acres and a mule at this time. And the bottom line is, America needs to pay black people what we're owed without a conversation about what we're going to do with it. That's none of your business.
What do we do then? Because it's leaders, you know, like Jim Clyburn, who just have that position, and I don't see him changing much. You know, usually when somebody, I don't know how old he is, but I would assume he's either 70 or close to, maybe even older. What do we do then at this point? So we got Trump out, okay? Allegedly. I believe he'll be out, because there's something called the Secret Service that will remove him.
Yeah.
So we got Trump out.
And if they don't want to do it, they can call me and some of the brothers from the hood. We have no problem going up there and moving him out.
So I guess, what do we... First of all, do you think pastors, and this is probably too quick of a long form answer, but I'm going to try to make it work within the time we have with you. Are pastors just weak? Are where's the backbone of the pastors and the bishops? And because it's a lot of selling out going there too. It's not just Jim Clyburn. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the faith-based initiative and how George Bush got elected, I guess, how do we go from here? Where are the leaders? I tell people that I'm excited that there's not one or two or three leaders, because it keeps people guessing and moving, and you have so many different voices. It's not the, I think one reason why they like referring back to MLK is because a lot of white folks feel comfortable having a Negro leader, you know, that they could say, well, you know, if MLK tell them to do X, Y, Z, it's all good.
And they only want the domesticized, sanitized MLK.
That's exactly right. And then, but if you look at MLK's strategy of making, you know, getting the church to be a voting block and using that power to accomplish civil rights gains, which is a good thing. But now I see a lot of ministers that use their that voting block or that access to the black voter as a pimp game. What MLK intended for this for it to be has been flipped. And we can tell because how many pastors are really speaking up on any of these issues?
Yeah.
So there is an issue with the church, obviously. And then you have the folks who say, hey, you shouldn't even be a Christian because you just do a number serving a white man and white supremacy and the Bible's on white supremacy. Right. So you have that conversation out there. You know, what do we do, Bishop? How do we really make these demands as black for black folks? And how do we keep this energy going? Because a lot of folks, especially the quote unquote woke, they just want to Trump out so they can go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Trump made people very uncomfortable. And I believe that that was an uncomfortable that was necessary. Not saying Trump was necessary, but we needed something to shake folks up, to shake up the system, to get people to pay attention. People that I have never talked to politics about said they were never interested in politics, didn't want to know at all. Because of Trump and him making it a daily reality show, people tapped in and they tapped in a way that I've never seen. So I want to make sure that they still stay engaged in the process. So how do we do that now that things will calm down? At least we won't have a president on Twitter every single day. How do we capture that and keep that momentum going? And then what do we do next?
I wrote a piece that dealt with the fact that Trump is a symptom of a pre-existing condition in America, that Trump wasn't the problem. He was the manifestation of a greater problem that we've always had. And I've always challenged our so-called white allies that all of a sudden got woke and became resistors when Trump got into office to not just be anti-Trump. I'm anti-white supremacy, anti-black bigotry and racism. You've got to be that too. Just being anti-Trump doesn't cut it, because at the end of the day, even when Trump is gone, extrajudicial murder of black people will continue. Disparities that exist in America will continue. And I told white folks that your apathy in the midst of all of this that was going on during Obama's administration, that was going on during Bush's administration, your apathy is what created mm-hmm. a Donald Trump. So that's the first point we got to get to, is this fight for justice has to live beyond Trump. When it comes to black preachers and the faith community, first of all, we who are preachers have to hold each other accountable. I'm in trouble in my city now. I got a whole pastor's council upset with me because I wrote a piece that challenged their apathy and their quietness in the midst of police brutality running rampant in our city. We've got to hold each other accountable. But ultimately, it's the people who sit in those pews who have to hold their leaders accountable. It's a shame before God that in my city, when people deal with police brutality and discrimination issues, they will go to such and such Baptist church, such and such AME church, such and such Pentecostal church of the world with a pastor that they pay tithe to and give money on his anniversary and all that stuff. But then they'll come knock on my door when they need help with those issues. And the first thing I ask them is, who's your pastor?
That's right.
And how come he's not helping you, you know, with these particular issues of concern? We've got to hold each other accountable. And see, the problem is the church has sold itself out and caught a case of laryngitis. The prophetic voice of the church has been muted. The late Dick Gregory said this. He said, when black people get in trouble, they call on the church, they call on the NAACP. This is the first time in the history of black America that we have a whole generation of activists and advocates that are neither connected to the church nor to any civil rights organization. Mm-hmm. And so folk in the church are sitting back critiquing these Black Lives Matter activists. But the reason why they're out there without your assistance is because you've abdicated your responsibility. And so we've got to hold them accountable one way or another. And if your pastor and your church is not doing what it should do, if it's not speaking truth to power, if it's not advocating for the rights and for justice for Black people, then you always can vote with your feet. And you can go to another church that does speak to those particular issues. Why would you continue to sit in those pews knowing that they're not doing what's in your best interest? But as long as you sit there and you tithe and you support, then they're going to continue to do what they do. And until you speak up and speak out, it won't change.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's a powerful word right there. As long you said, vote with your feet. Man, that is deep, Bishop. I could go on and on because you are such a wealth of knowledge. Before I close, I do want to, because it kind of ties into what you just said. You know, Democrats have taken the high road to me for far too long. They have taken the, you know, when they go low, we go high, and, you know, quoting Michelle Obama. And I would have to say, because I am a big critic of the Democrat Party, but this time around, I was impressed by their little light work. They little lightweight, you know, trying to get gangster with it just a little bit, not where I want to see it, but just a little bit. They turned up just a little bit. They had, I love the strategy of running 10 plus candidates. I think that was very wise, knowing that all of the candidates, remember they critiqued that in the beginning. Oh, everybody shouldn't be running. It's going to divide. No, every candidate that ran spoke to a different sector of America. And the goal was to talk to all of these different sectors of America and then coalesce behind one candidate. Now, we could go on and on how Biden was selected and so forth, but I don't want to spend time with that because the bottom line is he's going to the White House on January 20th. But I think that was wise. I also love how folks started going in places where the conversation was uncomfortable. You know, people criticize me because I go to Fox News, but somebody got to go to Fox News. Anybody can have a conversation in front of your own choir and in front of your own church members, but who goes to the other side of town to have the necessary conversation? So it seems that we're heading in the right direction with having uncomfortable conversations. But I want to ask, when you said, you know, white folks, make sure you stay involved. Do you really believe? Because that's one thing I say on this show all the time. I'm not really looking for allies. I think it's important that somebody has allies, but I'm not looking for them per se. I'm looking for soldiers. You know, Gideon's army, as you know, he started with 10,000 and ended up with 300. Some of these allies are just in the way. Some of them will not change who they are. Do you think we spend too much time taking the high road and needing to be reaffirmed with allies instead of just pushing our line for us and us alone when we talk about Black folks? And then I'm going to leave that last question with you and ask you to tie it up in a bow with that answer and give the people something that they can do moving forward, you know, to actually stay involved or get involved, because a lot of people have not been involved besides just talking among their own choir. You know, people love on Facebook. I tell my friends, you realize you're only talking to your circle. What are you doing outside your circle? That's just like gangbangers. Anybody can be tough in the hood, but when are you going to the other side of town and do some gangbanging on the enemy? So give us a word on that, Bishop. I think I said a couple of things. So one, have we taken the high road too much? How do we get gangster with this? Gangster Christians, the Old Testament, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And what would you recommend that folks can get involved since they're not attached to the church, not attached to the NAACP? What do they do to continue to hold this administration accountable and their peers and also the elected officials?
So you're right in that we shouldn't be looking for allies. We did a forum called From Allies to Accomplices. We need accomplices. We need folk who are going to put some skin in the game, that is going to put something on the line. See, the problem is we've got so-called allies who can check in and out of the movement when they want to, when it's convenient. As a Black person, I don't have the privilege of opting out this week or next week. I'm in this for life. And we need folks with us who are going to be in it for life. Not I was in it when Trump was president. Now I'm going back to my life as usual. So you've got to be able to move from an ally to an accomplice. And for far too long, we have been far too passive and too docile and talking about taking the high road. And, you know, even as a Christian, I'm cognizant of the fact that there were times where Jesus just got gangster and got the whip and started whipping folk and flipping tables and stuff. And the bottom line is, you've got to get to that point at some point in time. People criticize me all the time. You don't sound like a pastor. You clapping back at folk and all that kind of stuff. Well, no, you know, you just don't let the devil run roughshod, you know, over you, do and say whatever he wants to do and say, and then you sit back and pray about it. No, that's not how I roll. You know, if you roll up in my spot and you put my people at risk, you know, then the triple P comes out, the pistol packing preacher, you know, rolls out, and you're going to have to deal with all of this smoke. That's the bottom line to it. And as Christians, he never told us to lay down. And people have misinterpreted that scripture about turning the other cheek. It was not about being passive. It was not about being docile. They've misinterpreted thou shalt not kill. That's the proper transliteration is thou shalt not murder. If I kill you in self-defense, that's not murder. I'm a part Malcolm and a part Martin. And the part that's Malcolm is respect the law, treat everybody right. But if somebody puts his hands on you, send them to the cemetery. I believe in that. And we've got to do what we need to do to protect our lives, our livelihood, our families, and our communities. Bottom line. And, you know, from this point, people have to really take a vested interest that, and I'm talking to the people of faith now, that justice is not political. Justice is biblical. And if you're going to be true to your faith, you cannot be true to your faith and ignore the cause of justice. So whether it takes shape with you mentoring young minds at your church, with you becoming involved in your neighborhood councils, with you running for office, or with you writing a check and supporting some cause that is greater than you, with you coming out in support of those who are advocating and on the front lines, you've got to do something other than tweet and post and Instagram about something. That's wonderful when it comes to drawing attention to the matter, but you cannot bring about change by being an Instagram activist. You're going to have to come out from around your keyboard. You're going to have to come out from your phone, and you're going to have to hit the streets and deal with the issues that exist every single day. You need to be at the schools. You need to be at the school committee meeting speaking out about that jacked up curriculum they're teaching your child. You need to be at the city council meetings. You need to be holding these elected officials accountable. And when push comes to shove, when we need to be out there on the streets, you need to be out there as well. So I encourage everybody, don't let this moment lull you back to sleep that, oh, Trump is out now. You know, we can rest on our laurels, because here's the thing I'll close with. Every time there is black progress, there's white backlash. And you bet your bottom dollar it's coming. When America had the audacity to elect the first black president, the Tea Party rose up immediately. And they fooled y'all into thinking it was about policy issues. It wasn't. It was about the fact that America elected a black president. And 8 years later, what happened was what my good friend, Bishop W. Darren Moore said. He said, white folks in America became so nauseated by seeing a black family in the White House, they vomited, and out came Donald Trump. That was white backlash to black progress. And now y'all have the nerve, before a white woman could become vice president or president, to put a black woman in the White House? You better bet your bottom dollar come 4 years from now or whenever, there is going to be white backlash. These folk are going to lose it seeing a black woman rolling up in and out of the White House.
That's not there to do cooking and cleaning. Yeah.
And we got to be prepared for it.
That's deep. And a lot of people are saying that too. And it's not speaking from a place of fear. It is speaking from the reality of understanding what is to come. And that's really what I've been focused on. You know, Trump's in the mind of everybody. They still focus on talking about Trump. Look, it's over with. Let's start getting to work at this point.
Yeah.
Because we cannot allow him to consume your mind every day, the anxiety. Because guess what? Guess what his plan is for the next 4 years? To continue to do what he has done times 10, because if you think he didn't have accountability, then wait until you see when there's literally no accountability at all.
Like the poem I learned in the 10th grade, do not go gently into that good night. Trump ain't going gently. Trust me.
Oh, no question. No question. So he's not going gently. So we have to stand strong. Bishop, where can people find you and follow you? All of your work. I encourage everybody to go check your clapbacks. You got some of the best in the game. I know I'm a clapback queen myself, but you have one of the best in the game. So how can people find you on Twitter, and where else should they be following you, and give us some information about your church?
You can go to talbertswan.org. And all of my social media is at Talbert Swan, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and they even got me on TikTok now. I have no idea how to use Snapchat, but I'm there too. So just follow me at Talbert Swan. My church, Springer Hope Church of God in Christ, right here in the hood at Six Corners in Springfield, Massachusetts. You can also catch us streaming live every Sunday morning at 11 and on Wednesdays at 7:30. I'd love to have you be a part of our experience.
And thank you so much for joining. I love when I am speaking to an Old Testament Christian that understands the old and the new do go together. I quote all the time Deborah from the Book of Judges, and a warrior. And she told General Barak, which was his name literally, mm-hmm. that if you do not deliver my people from poverty, he will do it from the hand of a woman. So I am so grateful to be able to use my voice, my platform to speak with you today. I do hope people listen to this and listen to it over and over, because you dropped some gems up in here today, Pastor. I just appreciate you stopping by and leaving us a word. There's so many things that I want to talk to you about as we move forward. And hopefully this is not the last time that we can connect, because like you said, we do have work to do. This is literally just the beginning of an administration. We have so much more far that we need to go to continue building. Straight Shooters, make sure you listen to this. Share this with someone that you know. And more importantly, share it with somebody that you love. Because this type of wisdom that was given to you today is not only a benefit to the Black community, and it's okay for us to say that here. This is the Black Effect Podcast Network. So it's okay for us to love on Black folks on this network. Share it with someone that you love. But also what Bishop said, share it with an accomplice. I love that. Those who listen to my show know I always say I'm not looking for allies, I'm looking for soldiers, because like Bishop said, allies have an opportunity to pick and choose when they want to be involved. And I have said that very thing. It sent chills to me when Bishop said it, because I have said that very thing repeatedly almost on every show. Find an accomplice that's willing to put some skin in the game. We are at the point now where you must be a player on the field. Being in the stands is not acceptable. We have to move the ball. We have to continue to move forward. We are not going to agree on everything that this administration does. That is the beautiful part of democracy and the beautiful part of having a voice. The question is, what we always must do is make our voice heard. Thank you so much to my guest, Bishop, for joining us today. Bishop Talbert Swan, go follow him and support him, because we need Twitter folks in the pews too. We need folks who jump in, support, click like, deal with the trolls. You know, we need soldiers there too. But like Bishop said, it is beyond just being on Twitter. We need you in these streets. Thank you so much, guys, for listening. And until next time, this is your girl, Teslin Figueroa, Straight Shot No Chaser Podcast. If you like what you heard on Straight Shot No Chaser, please subscribe and drop a 5-star review and tell a friend. Straight Shot No Chaser is a production of the Black Effect Podcast Network and iHeartRadio. I'm Teslin Figueroa, and I'd like to thank our producer, editor, mixer, the one and only Marcy DePina, our mix master, Dwayne Crawford, and our executive producer, Charlamagne Tha God. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.